Radio Tux. The German Linux Radio. The German Linux
Radio. On tour. From 2010, the Rafa Camp in Brussels. My name's Uli Kleemann and you're listening Radio Tux. Apropos bomb, the first bomb unclasped on 2010 Serafa Summer Camp, in my humble opinion, was this year's keynote, Love and Hate Between Open Source Reality and Community Dream, given by Stephen Sherman, co-founder of SpringSource, in which he revealed the differences between community and business thinking deploying software. I asked him if he feels real hate or simply misunderstanding, let's say, of some specific sort.
Hello, this is Uli Kleemann from Serafa Summer Camp, and with me now is this year's keynote speaker, Stephen Schumann, the co-founder of SpringSource. Hello, Stephen.
Hi.
Welcome to Radio Tux. Stephen, for all of our listeners who don't know SpringSource, what is SpringSource? What are you doing?
Well, SpringSource is basically the company that is behind the Spring Framework. And the Spring Framework is probably the world's most popular enterprise Java framework for building custom applications. And that's what it's most notable for. It is also the company that supports Tomcat, Tomcat application server, which is one of the most popular, if not the most popular application server, open source application server in the world. And what SpringSource also has is a suite of applications and tooling to build, manage, and run custom build applications all in enterprise Java.
Okay, but you left SpringSource, if I figured out correctly, and now run the J team in Amsterdam.
Yes, that's true. It was SpringSource was acquired by American company VMware late 2009, and basically when it was acquired, at some point I decided that I wanted to go back to the company I was at before I was at SpringSource. And that's JTeam. JTeam is an Amsterdam-based system integrator that's completely specialized in building enterprise Java custom applications using tons of open source software. So I'm using some of the SpringSource stuff again to help customers.
Okay, that's fine. You gave a keynote today titled Love and Hate Between Open Source Reality and Community Dreams. Is there really a kind of hate between the community and the business, in your opinion? Or is it more kind of a special misunderstanding?
Well, I think there's definitely both. I believe that there are misunderstandings, but what I'm seeing is that there's also some almost religious battles between the open source people, the prominent open source people, because some really feel that open source software should be free, should be reusable, should be there for the masses, and is not there to be used by commercial companies, and definitely not there to make money off of. And there's obviously a whole different group of people that believe that open source is a great way to help customers, but also to, for example, create adoption for a certain product or create an ecosystem for a certain product, and that product that they create an ecosystem for might very well be a commercial product. So there is misunderstanding, but there's also just two camps that sometimes just don't want to understand each other.
Okay, so could it also be that the cooperation between business on one side and the open source community on the other side is maybe we could say a kind of a, let's say, shotgun wedding? So
that's an interesting analogy. No, I don't think so, because what you do see is that in community open source, it's not the majority of the people that believe that it is completely evil to make money off of open source software. There's a group that's pretty vocal, that has been around for ages. Some people are sometimes converted to the other side of the camp, but that doesn't happen very often. But it's not a shotgun wedding. I think that there is that the majority of the people believes that you can do with open source as you see fit, and there are simply different models, and one is pure community and not there to make money off of, completely non-profit, and there is corporate open source, and that sometimes involves cash flow of some sort.
Okay, taming the tension, what do you think? What are the main reasons for this tension? Is this that they both parts live in different worlds of some kind, or...?
I believe the tension is caused predominantly because, on the one hand, kind of the socialistic way to look at open source software completely clashes with the capitalistic way of looking at software, and it's just two very different beliefs, and both groups with those very different beliefs use, build, create open source software. So there is just the open source communities are made up out of completely different groups of people, and that's why there is tension. It's just what it is.
Ah, okay. Well, we had an interview a few days ago at LinuxTag in Berlin with the guy who implemented Linux on the mainframe, and he told us that when IBM started this project, there was a statement from one of the managers in USA who said, well, open source is programming for communists. Maybe hard to understand in one case, but on the other hand, for somebody who comes from the enterprise environment, wants to join the community and to cooperate with the community, there are maybe some obstacles between them, and could it also be that the community is maybe only afraid of stepping back to times, I remember when there was no open source available? So we can, or we have maybe to avoid a second Microsoft?
Well, I don't know whether the community wants to avoid a second Microsoft. I think that, about your previous comment about somebody stating that open source is for communists, I believe that, well, when... a couple of years ago, when there were these really, really strong differences between the commercial camp and the more the community, the free camp, if so to speak, then there were there were people in companies that actually thought that open source was communistic of nature, but I think now that's less. I don't think there are many companies out there anymore that still view open source as purely communistic, simply because open source business models are starting to prove themselves. There are plenty of companies, and SpringSource is just one example, but there's dozens and dozens of other companies that made a very good living on various open source software related business models and did very well. So I believe that we've been there, and I don't think that there are many companies, maybe some very traditional proprietary software companies that still view it as communistic, but I think this is from back in the days, and there are not many people like that anymore.
I understand. Back to business. When I got here by car, I had a discussion with my driver and about the problems selling open source in enterprise environments, and he told me about one of his experience with a large customer who he offered open source software, and when it comes to the second talk, he got the answer, well, our enterprise isn't ready yet for open source software. So for me as a salesman, a typical case that they didn't talk maybe the same language, and as we all know, there are a lot of different licensing models in the open source environment. There's, for example, the GPL, the AGPL, there is a Mozilla license, there is a BSD license, maybe nice stuff to discuss for lawyers, but could that maybe be one reason that denies a little bit general acceptance of open source software in the environment of large enterprises?
Absolutely. I think that one of the main reasons we see, and actually mostly saw, because open source is obviously getting more and more adopted in large enterprises, and I'm inclined to say that, well, at least for the last 12 months or so, I have not come across many companies that just bluntly state our company is not ready for open source, because that's like stating that our company is not ready for email. You don't go there anymore. But there definitely was a time, and there still is to some extent, still some issues around predominantly the legal side of open source, because, well, if you have a proprietary license, you can say it's from commercial company ABC, and what are the odds that this product actually infringes on a certain patent, which might subsequently open you up to all kinds of legal liabilities and financial lawsuits and that kind of stuff. With open source, you don't always know exactly what the source is. You don't know whether a certain product infringes on certain patents. What we do see, though, is that especially the large, relatively successful open source projects, whether they're backed up by a commercial corporation or whether they're community-driven projects, they don't really have to deal with that issue anymore, because in practice, we haven't seen loads of lawsuits arise over the years, and open source has been around for quite a long time, around patent infringements in open source. I'm sure it happens, but I could not tell you off the bat, and I've been around in open source for quite some time, I couldn't tell you some major lawsuits. It's just not that common. So I think people are getting more and more comfortable. That's one reason, because there aren't too many issues. The other reason is because open source has a tendency to be bottom up. It just starts. It enters an organization from the bottom, from the developers that just download something and simply start using small libraries, small pieces of software in their applications. And even within companies that have a strict no open source policy, I'm almost 100% convinced that if you would analyze that code base, you will find a significant chunk of open source code in their app. So it's there anyway. So there's really no point in fighting it.
Okay. Password lawsuits, does this simply not boil down to the point that simply in practice none of the, let's say, white collars simply understand the meaning of the license or the meaning of open source?
Absolutely. I think that is definitely part of it. That's becoming less and less, because what you see now is that there are more lawyers and law firms even that have groups of specialist lawyers that know pretty much everything there is to know about open source licensing, or at least a whole lot about open source licensing. I actually just literally 20 minutes ago ran into somebody, and I've just arrived at the conference. I spoke to a lawyer that's specialized in open source licenses. So there's the knowledge is there also on the legal side. So it's I think there's that helps.
Okay, arguing with these purists of open source, you always hear the same arguments. One is that open source should always be completely free and reusable. Okay. I would slightly agree with this. Another point is against open source mainly is the support, and the argument from the community as well. The support from the community is usually excellent, but is the meaning of support as the community understands it maybe different from the meaning of support as a company understands it?
I think that's a very good question. And There is a difference, but it all depends not so much, I think, on whether a company views it differently from how the community views support. I think this is all about needs and requirements of users. I think that if you have an open source component that you use in your application, and it's simply not absolutely mission critical, you simply need a different level of support than when you have like your entire high volume transactional system based on an open source server. If that server goes down, you want to be able to contact somebody that can realistically commit to superior service level agreements, right? With regards to response time, with regards to following the sun across the globe, with regards to high response times. It all depends on where you use your open source software and what your requirements are, and that is different. I don't think the people just view it differently. I think it's more in different needs.
Okay, that helps me to switch over to the most important point, in my opinion. What means picking the right open source product? Imagine that I had to do a decision pro or against open source. I must confess that I would be simply feel overwhelmed from all this bazaar offer. So, from your experience, how to pick up the right open source product for a company? Or are there maybe some kind of indicators that can show me that the project will fit to my needs or not?
Well, there are definitely indicators that you can look at. I believe that ultimately with anything you purchase, whether it's a car or a kitchen or a house or a piece of software, you need to look at the specifications. Does it fit my needs? Does it do what I need it to do? And specifications are usually available in proprietary software products and in commercial product. Proprietary software products and in open source products. They're everywhere. I think that's where it starts. But then that's where it gets different, because what you can find in on many occasions is that if once you've spec'd out your requirements, there might be two or three proprietary products that fit your needs and two or three or four open source products that meet your needs. And I think then one of the most important things is that you look at, well, obviously the budget. Sometimes simply due to budgetary constraints, people have to go open source or have to choose between either a superior open source product or a low-end proprietary product. And that's when, well, it kind of, you make a first distinction. And subsequently, I think what you look at is like things like reliability. If you need a solution for a problem that doesn't require you to have a super uber reliable solution, then well, you might be able to a relatively mid-range open source, maybe even completely free solution might suffice. And if you have let's say a payment processing application for a bank that is very, very critical, well, then you either have to go for a completely reliable proprietary solution or a very, very reliable open source solution. And that's when you check out who's behind it. Is there a vendor behind it? And then usually what you will find out is that both in open source and in proprietary software, there will be a vendor behind the product. And then, do I go for proprietary or do I go for open source? In my opinion, if there is an open source alternative that's good enough, it will be cheaper, there will be less vendor lock-in, you will have all the benefits from open source and save some money. So there, in my opinion, you would go for an open source product.
Okay. Last question, Stephen. As we've seen in your talk, the meaning of the collocation open source to people is various. Some think it's a business model, others think it's a revenue model, others even say it's a kind of philosophy. What does it mean to you?
Well, to me, I think I'm definitely an entrepreneur at heart. I'm not much of a pure socialist. I definitely do see that, especially starting companies benefit from the fact that there's excellent, excellent open source software available that is completely free and that can be reused. And I think that it's this kind of open source, the kind of the, well, what some view as the socialistic side of open source, is very important for young companies to get going and to help drive innovation, create new offerings, get into new markets, expand quickly. I think that it is that kind of open source that, that's part of open source that I think is very good to for an economic climate. Personally, I view open source as basically an excellent way to help customers and help companies. There is not one answer. It is definitely a major driver for corporations. Is a major driver for innovation, and it helps both, well, young companies that cannot spend a lot of money on software still do the things that they want to do, and it also helps larger businesses get into new market segments, new markets, and drive revenue. So it's, for me, it's actually a bit of both, I guess.
Okay, so thank you for coming around, spending your time for Radio Tax.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, what swinging sound and what patience it needs to get a top manager on a microphone beyond words. Smart questions to ask, extremely helpful. A secretary who drives him, priceless. So thanks, Mariam, for making this possible.
So we are now taking a look at Serafa Company, and therefore with me now is Brian Joseph, CEO of Serafa. Hello, Brian. Welcome at Radio Tax.
Good afternoon. Nice to speak with your listeners.
Okay. Brian, as I figured out from your website, Serafa is one of the fastest growing companies in groupware, and as I also figured out from your talk this morning, you reached the 100,000 users line in public services. Looking back on all this, how did it all start with Serafa?
It started with a group of people who were very enthusiastic about open source. Speaking for myself, I got in touch in 1995 when I was in Southern Africa helping isolated areas with no access to water. And I worked there and was heavily using open source software there like IronDraw and LaTeX. Got very enthusiastic about that, also in training people, and I would say the untapped potential of resources, because I saw that other people also got very motivated and wanted to spend time on that. And then with other open source enthusiasts, we start to work together, where we thought in 2005 we should start to focus on the area of groupware and collaboration and really go for the area of office automation, where Office is very deeply integrated, also related to email. So then we decided we want to go in open source groupware, where we want to be compatible with existing environments and existing desktops. So that's how it started when we launched in 2006 at the CeBIT, the Serafa solution.
Okay. And how many people currently work for your company for Serafa?
We just passed this year, in 2010, the number of 50 people.
50 people, wow. Quite a number. So because of your growth, I assume that you are still looking for new co-workers, am I right?
That is right, in every dimension, from development to commercial to quality assurance to engineering.
Uh-huh. As many of our listeners are students of information technology, respectively electronics and things like that, what kind of associates you are looking for and what should a successful candidate bring with to fit your team?
I would say, in general, we look for people who take responsibility, who don't mind to make one time a mistake to innovate, but then learn from that so much that they don't make it the second time. Who like to have fun, get inspired by such an open source team. And I would say people who develop software that we would like to use, and we can see that. That's typically the type of candidates that we like to work together with.
Okay. So. Okay, fine. Another question: how would you describe your management philosophy?
Yeah, it's a little bit in line how I talked. So the last part of my answer was more: what are we looking for in a candidate? And our management philosophy is a combination of fun, responsibility, and be innovative. So accept you make a mistake and learn from it, so you then don't make it twice. That's those three values are the core of our management philosophy.
Okay. As you're one of our sponsors from Radio Tax, I assume that the community has a big significance for Sarafa. What is the significance of the open source community for Sarafa?
It is both from, I would say, a business model and an innovation perspective. From a business model, it's very good for Sarafa that Sarafa has been adopted by many major distributions, which enables much more organizations to get in touch with our software. For us, that's of course very good, because there's always a percentage who's interested to go for our enterprise version. And from the innovation model, we learn from all those organizations. That starts from feedback at our forum and just personal emails related to quality assurance and to ideas and fixes, and that ends up with, right now, to more and more contributions from the community.
I see. Another point is open source technology. Many companies, many enterprises are afraid a little bit of using open source technology, maybe because of a more or less false impress of how it is developed. And what are your main motivation using open source technologies for Sarafa?
It is that business model, and the innovation model that I just mentioned, and also personal desire or fascination to use the untapped resources available in the world. And then, yeah, we are focused here in this group here that build a better collaboration platform together with others who spend their resources on that. And that's what I really like, that there's intelligent, inspirational people who join the whole movement to work together.
As far as I know, Sarafa is completely open source on one hand, and on the other hand, there is a community edition and also an enterprise edition. For our not so technical, familiar listeners about Groupware, what are the main differences between those editions?
There is an open source version, which has for a user access to web access, to use email, to use web-based email and calendar, and to share email and calendar and contacts. At the same time, you can use the compatibility with ActiveSync mobility, like the iPhone, and to IMAP-based Fed clients like Thunderbird. That's the whole open source stack. On top of that, people can decide to use our commercial enterprise version, which gives you on top of that some features which enable compatibility with closed source, like the BlackBerry Enterprise Server, support on the software, and updates and upgrades via maintenance that is in that whole package.
Mm-hmm. As I figured out also from mainly from my website, on the other hand, we at RadioTax also use Serefa for a couple of time. Serefa offers, e.g., a couple of great features, IMAP and POP3 solution, iCardiff capability, active sync capability, and finally it can save you 50% TCO. Please apologize this heretical question, but facing to all these fantastic features, Microsoft Exchange and Outlook are still the top dogs. What do you think are the main reasons therefore? Is it maybe the user habits, respectively, they are worse to change it, or what do you think, why Serefa hasn't become here the market leader?
I think there is, like in every market, people are used to a certain technology. I think then in ICT, let's say, maybe 20% of the people are either very skilled and very used to either Microsoft technology or to, on the other hand, open source technology. So for those people, the TCO and the arguments are very much related to the knowledge they already have. So that means that people very skilled in Microsoft would take Microsoft, people very skilled in open source would take an open source collaboration solution. Then for the other 80%, in general, I would say larger organizations play a safe bet in taking the market leader solution. You could say you've never been fired for buying Microsoft, but in these economic times, you could lay off if you haven't analyzed the alternatives and other solutions. So I think step by step, organizations are seeing the value of other solutions. Serefa works with a subscription model instead of a license model, which means that inherently you pay for added value, like also support and other extras. And related to that, you have a better TCO. And when there is, I would say, equal knowledge and brand name, there would be, to come back to your question, there should not be a reason why Serefa would not grow to much higher market share.
For you, you take this crisis as a chance, if I understood you correctly.
Yeah, I think every solution which is where organizations and potential customers understand as transparent as possible where they pay for each solution that has that characteristic will benefit from the crisis, we think.
Oh, let's see what happens. Another buzzword, virtualization. Maybe today's greatest hype. What local values Serefa ascribes to virtualization in the range of groupware and collaboration especially?
In general, Serefa benefits from its open source nature, which is very flexible, which gives very interesting optimizations in a virtualized setup, which means, for example, splitting database server from your MTA like Postfix, splitting that from your web server. That's all very much more flexible than Exchange used to be. We benefit from that, and at the same time, we as the Serefa team, we deal with virtualization every day for our own environment, for environments that we see at our customers. So that means that we, in terms of optimized configuration, we get our knowledge. That's also what workshops here at the summer camp all about. People are discussing typically virtualized setup because it's there, it's out there.
Let's switch over maybe now to your aims. Which market precisely, which segment do you aim for, and why especially for this market, respectively market segment?
One of the segments where we see above average adoption is the public sector segment, and we also motivate customers and our partners to target this segment. We think it's driven by the transparency and grip and related vendor independence that is important for governments, because they run their organizations with public money, so those values are important. And we think open source delivers those values. That's why open source is in the policy of public sector of many public sector organizations. So there is a good fit there.
Last question, Brian. As we all know, Serafa is sold in cooperation with distributors like Red Hat, Unimension, or Calyx. How is this structured? Are they more independent partners, or are they more led as subsidiaries, or how does this work?
I would have news if I would say that Red Hat is a subsidiary of Serafa, which is of course not the case. Now we have with both at, I would say, at marketing perspective, delivery perspective, and R&D or technology exchange perspective, we work together with those type of organizations. For example, with Collax, we work in all three areas together, where they deliver total all-in-one solution, including, for example, security and archiving bundled with Serafa. So there's also, from a delivery perspective, a cooperation with Red Hat and Univention. There is, from a marketing and a an R&D and innovation perspective, a cooperation with Red Hat, next to knowledge exchange between their virtualization specialists and our virtualization specialists. We see that also that Serafa is embodied in the Fedora distribution.
Last question now. What are your targets for the next year with Serafa, and how can the community support Serafa?
Our target set is that we continue our adoption in target segments like the public sector, that we grow the ecosystem of ISVs, integrators, and the community around it, not only in number but also in the intensity of their contributions and their expertise. So that's I would say that means an impulse that should go from two directions. So we as Serafa should make it even easier for the community to contribute. We do that in giving a next impulse in our communication systems, and like we want to go to an open book tracker. Other things are that we release a new web access in which it will be much easier to create plugins, so it will be very easy for every PHP developer to create his own integrations. That's, I would say, technology and the technology components and community processes that we want to enforce to realize an even more intensive two-way interaction.
Okay. So said, let's see what future will bring. Thank you very much for today, for coming.
Thank you as well.
The interview. Hope we meet again next year at Serafa Camp 2011. Yes. Thank you very much. Bye, Brian.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Before you ask what was the best event at the event, the social event, of course. Good food, cool people, nice girls, and cold Belgian beer. Doing an interview after all this, anything but easy. However, Steve Hardy, Serafa's CTO, demonstrates how it goes and how you could have fun with it.
Good morning, my fellow listeners. This is Uli from the Serafa Summer Camp in Brussels again. and TGIF. Thank God it's Friday, and thank God we have him here. Steve Hardy, Sarafa's CTO.
Good morning,
Steve.
Good morning. Well, pretty well.
Pretty well.
It was a busy day yesterday,
yeah.
But...
Couple of good fine Belgian beer.
Yeah, a couple of good beers, and up in early in the morning again to do the presentation.
Okay, I hope the questions aren't too hard for you, because you offered a bet. Any question you cannot answer, so I will win a T-shirt. So
that's true.
Yeah, that's why I'm really here.
So I'll tell you what, I'll give you a T-shirt anyway.
okay, so you can have maybe an exclusive next interview with Radio Talks. Okay.
Great.
Steve, as we already had Brian here yesterday, we had a look on Sarafa. I will try to look behind Rafa's technology and techniques. As I figured out from your talk this morning, you have something new presented here on SummerCam, buzzword integration.
Yep.
But before we go any further, first question from me is there are... a couple of groupware solutions out there. Don't want to mention them all. But the most interesting question in this context is what is so special about Sarafa in contrast to the others, particularly with regard to the special structure and the way Sarafa internally fills the files?
Yeah, well, this is actually quite a large difference between Sarafa and most of the other solutions out there. The main big thing is that we started off with by saying we're going to take a data model which fits a number of needs, and one of the early needs was that we wanted to have a MAPI support. This is API MAPI, and that was kind of a core requirement back in the days that we started out, and we built all the rest around that. If you compare that with other solutions that are out there, the other solutions basically said, we want to create a new groupware, and usually they've created it around their web interface, and they've created their data model around their web interface. We've done it basically the other way around. We said, no, we want this data model, and then we built the web access and the web web systems and all the other tools around that data model. And that data model is really important for us because it's given us a lot of things, including Outlook compatibility, BlackBerry compatibility, but also a lot of performance things. We've added indexing, things like that. So main difference, we based it around the data model, whereas other people first built their web interface and then basically made their data model out of that.
I understand. On the other hand, there's something I've forgotten to mention. We have a little rule at Radio Talk, so whenever we use a collocation or abbreviation, we have to explain it shortly for the not so familiar listeners. And Sarafa basically founds on three technologies. There's MAPI on one side, ICS, and OS.
Yeah.
Would you be so kind maybe to describe it? What does it mean?
Well, MAPI is quite a stupid abbreviation, really, because it just stands for messaging API, API is application programming interface, but it's just a technology to store, retrieve, search inside groupware data. So whether it's email or calendaring doesn't really matter, but it's a C++ API, and it allows developers to create normally applications that can do groupware stuff. And one of the applications is our web access, for example, or one of the applications is a backup tool. So MAPI, just messaging API. ICS is another technology that we use, which is incremental change synchronization, which is a replication mechanism that can be used for various things. But we use it, for example, for offline synchronization. So you've got an offline database, you've got an online database, and you want to synchronize that at some point when you get onto the internet. You want to synchronize your offline stuff. And what ICS does is that it basically, it's also an API, so it's a programming interface, and it can tell you what has changed since the last time. So basically, when I go online, ICS can tell you, oh, since the last time that you were here, you got 5 new emails, 3 were moved, and 2 were edited. And the last one is not really a technology, it's just open source in general. And we Yeah, we lean a lot on a lot of open source, other open source projects. We've always said we don't want to be this huge project which implements everything that everyone did anyway, like an MTA or a mail server. We're going to take the existing packages or software that's already there and use that inside our package. So, yeah, Zarafa wouldn't do much without the other open source community projects, and that's really important for us as well, of course.
Okay, so much for that. Another buzzword you were already mentioned, compatibility. We all know that slogan, designed for that proprietary OS that I'm not allowed to mention here on RadioPax. From my experience, that for me that means hands off from this piece of hardware, because it's not compatible to anything else on this planet.
Yeah.
So integration into and compatibility is vital for Zarafa. So how do you handle to bring these, let's say, worlds together?
Well, yeah, it's two things really. Of course, we've got the Windows side and the Linux side. Firstly, I think we bring it together in two ways. Firstly, we've got a lot of developers working on Zarafa, which are who are not maybe purely Linux developers. They're Linux developers, but they also know Windows. And we do a lot of cross-platform development. So almost everything that we make builds in both Windows and in Linux. But obviously, we only ship the product for Linux. There's no point in making the product for Windows. So we bring that all together in that way, that we have a lot of cross-platform software. So we've got a Windows components, we've got Linux components. Most of it is in Linux, though, of course. Then compatibility-wise, which is kind of different area, is that we always start out with this MAPI base, and then we say, okay, we've got another client, say on a Mac or say on a telephone. How can we bring the application to that device? Usually, it's just through a protocol. So whether it's implementing IMAP or if it's implementing the synchronization technology for your mobiles. There's a lot of work that goes into Zarafa implementing protocols, finding out what's the incompatibilities there, and making those all compatible in the protocol. So compatibility is most often the case is figuring out the protocols and making it all work together with all the different applications.
Okay. Another point is while other business applications, e.g. colleagues, business server, more or less force me as administrator to use a graphical interface, argumenting that editing on the shell makes no sense, more or less. As far as I know, Zarafa still offers no graphical admin interface. Why that?
Well, I really see Zarafa as a real core technology company. We really focus on the real hardcore development, which is really looking at performance, getting systems to work with 5,000 concurrent users, doing SSD technology, optimizing I/O strategies, things like that. That's what we're really, really, really good in, and I think we've proven that in the past 4 or 5 years. And we've got a lot of partners and also companies and also community around Zarafa which create these interfaces. So we've always said, we'll keep to what we do best, and that's doing the packages, doing the actual hardcore software. And there's a lot of other people who are much better than us in making graphical user interfaces and making management interfaces. So we basically, that's also a pattern that you see a lot, of course, in open source, that it works that way. On the other hand, of course, we also have our commercial activities, and we need to make our money there. So we have partners, also commercial partners, who make money just because they have these management interfaces. So we it's not even commercially really easy to say, oh, we've got our product as well. It's going to be in the way of our partners as well. And lastly, a lot of our users, they set up Zarafa once with the command line, maybe in the back end, and an integration with various parts. But the day-to-day administration, so adding users and things like that, you usually do that in your LDAP LDAP management interface, or if you have a Windows environment, you do that in your Active Directory. So you already have a management interface for your day-to-day management, and for a lot of users, that's enough already. So that's the main thing. We just focus on our core there, and I don't see us releasing a management interface in the near future. Maybe next year, but not in the near future.
Okay. Another point, comparing Zarafa with those existing, let's say, more or less dinosaurs like Lotus Notes or Open Exchange, where usually one of them still exists in companies.
Yep.
Is there a migration guide?
Well, obviously, we've got a lot of documents that we've made with people already migrating. I must say directly that there's it's kind of a paradox here. There's so many different setups for people. Even Lotus Notes differs from one party to the other. So you can't really just make one document that just, if you say this, if you do this, then you're migrated. It also depends on what do you mind want to migrate. Do you just want to migrate everyone's email? Do you want to do their calendar as well, or their contacts? And that's a really complex thing. So we can't just make one document that does it all. On the other hand, all of the products out there have some kind of IMAP support. So that means that if you want to do email migration, then you can do it through IMAP. You pull it out of one IMAP server and you put it into the other. So that's a really standardized thing. And we've got documents on our website and in our wiki which basically say, oh, if you want to do the email migration, then you can do it with these tools and these tools. But we can't make one kind of one document saying this is how it goes. And of course, we also have to look at where are most of our customers coming from. And a lot of them, of course, come from Lotus Notes and things like that. But also a lot of them come from Exchange. And from Exchange, we have tools that just migrate all your data in one go. So the migration plan there is start the migration tool, do the data, and you're done.
Okay. Another point. As Linux comes in many phases, then we have Red Hat, we have Fedora,
yep.
We have Ubuntu, we have others based on Debian. How did you solve the integration into other distributions, and how packages are offered? Only as a binary or also as source?
No, we deliver binaries and source. In practice, most people just download the binaries.
Mm.
We have a huge build system that builds for, I think, something like 36 different distributions, including 32-bit, 64-bit, and even IA64. And we basically add new operating systems as they come. So when a new SUSE comes out, we add that to the build system. The next release will have that build. In theory, you can just download the source and build that yourself, but most people just wait for the binary distribution. On the other hand, there's also some operating systems like Fedora who have in which Zarafa is actually in the repository, and in that case, it's the maintainer's job to make the binaries. So we don't deliver the binaries on our website because it's already in the repository for Fedora, for example. And they also use slightly different structures for their packages. Which we talked to them about, by the way, and that's all fine how they do it, and it looks really great. But we'll keep adding new distributions as long as we're not in their standard repository. So, huge build system.
Okay. Another point to mention is as Linux comes not from the cathedral, respectively, it comes from the bazaar. We have a zoo of MTAs. We have Postfix, we have Sender, we have QML, and not all to mention. Question for our nerds. How does this integration work technically?
Well, it's quite easy, really, because from the standpoint of Zarafa, Zarafa isn't really an email server. It's a collaboration server, and we only store data. So we don't actually ever send data anywhere unless a user actually presses on send. That's the only moment in which we ever have to send anything to the MTA. So that's quite easy, really, because, yeah, if you want to send an email, we just connect with port 25, and we SMTP the email outside, and that's it for sending email. So, yeah, each MTA obviously supports SMTP, so it doesn't really matter if you're using XM or POSIX or whatever. It's going to work because it's port 25 and it's SMTP. So that's outgoing. And then for incoming email, that's the only other point where you want to actually integrate with your MTA. How you configure that all with your relaying, all this is all up to you. It's just at the moment that you actually want to deliver the email. So normally when you're going to deliver it into, I don't know, a mail dir or something like that, instead of delivering it into the mail dir, you want to deliver it into Zarafa. There's two ways to do that at the moment. One is using the actual mail delivery agent, which we provide, which is Zarafa D agent, which is just a tool that takes an RFC 822 email and puts it in your inbox. That's the easiest way. Or maybe, yeah, it depends on what MTA you're using. The other way is using LMTP, which is a subset of SMTP, which is a local mail transfer protocol. All it does is it's only the last step of the delivery is used with LMTP. And you can, for example, set up POSIX quite easily to say, okay, for the delivery of this email, connect to port 2003 LMTP and deliver the email there. And then you're just running a daemon, and that accepts all your LMTP data, and there you are. So there's only two points where you integrate. Outgoing email is really simple. Incoming is also quite simple. LMTP or just a delivery agent.
Okay, so let's now switch over to collaboration. Mm. As I figured out from your press release, collaboration platform 640 is now available. What new features will it bring?
Well, it has a lot of new features, actually, and I'm sure if I stop talking about it now, I'm going to forget a few. But the main important things are that we add a new indexer for searching. So we took a Lucene search indexer, which basically takes all your email attachments, all this stuff, indexes all the text inside them. So whenever you search for something, it'll be almost instant search results that will not only search through your email, but also the attachments in your email. That's one thing we added. We added a lot more performance features for really large setups. So when you're running more than 2,000 concurrent users, for example, we put it in some more pooling. In the web access, we added some things like an advanced search filter, so you can search for emails like older than so many days with an attachment from this person. Yeah, there's a lot more smaller features that we also added in the web access, like keyboard controls and things like that. But yeah, those are the main big features in the 640. But for the entire list, you can take a look on the website.
Yeah,
we have a change log there.
Of course.
It's about I think there's about 25 large new features.
Uh-huh.
Also for me, it's 640 is released now. Of course, we started working on that more than a year ago.
Uh-huh.
So for me, these new features are actually quite old already.
Okay, then let's have a look on the brand new features. Web Access 7 came out, and as I read, it's now completely plugin based.
Yeah, well, it's not out.
Not out?
No, it's not finished.
Oh.
It will not be finished this year.
Not be finished this
no.
year?
No. So we're going to version 7.0. We chose to go to a new major version, so not to to 6 point something, but 7.0, mainly because the web access will completely change the way that it looks. And so users will see something completely different. The reason for that is that we switched from basically using our own framework for our web access to an XJS-based framework. And it's actually a complete rewrite of the web access front end. So that's a really new thing. It's completely plugin based, and that means that each component that we write in the web access is actually just a plugin. And that's really nice for plugin developers, because that means that you can do anything with the plugin. Because if we can make the entire web access with the plugin, then you can do anything you like with the plugin system as well.
Mm-hmm.
We also use the documentation system from XGS, so it's really nice documentation for the plugin developers. And we've got a nice widget system where you can have widgets, I don't know, maybe an instant messaging client in there and things like that. So you can really nicely plug things into the web access there. The other big thing, though, which you didn't really ask me, but I'm going to tell you anyway, is that we didn't have Unicode support until now.
Yeah.
We only had Western European support up to 640. We always said, yeah, this is a big thing that we have to add, and we always kind of said, oh, we'll do that. We'll do it later, because it's not a very hard project, but it's a very, it touches every line of code basically in your code base. So we said for 7.0, we're only going to do two things. We're going to add the new web access, which is a complete rewrite, and we're going to do the Unicode stuff. And that's what we're doing, and we actually have we're quite far with that already with the Unicode stuff. It works pretty well. I consider myself Japanese and Chinese emails and things like that. Yeah, so that's what we're adding for next year. But that, as I said, that 7.0, we won't be releasing that anywhere near this year. So yeah.
Uh-huh. And another thing is that you also changed to a Python API.
Yeah.
Why that?
Well, we added a new Python. There's really two reasons for that. We already had two APIs that you could use for Zarafa, and there was the C++ MAPI API. MAPI is the stuff I was talking about earlier. The C++ native API. You can already use that to write tools. I don't know, to integrate with, let's say, an Asterisk server to do a voicemail or deliver voicemails in your inbox and things like that. We already had that. We already also had a PHP API, which we actually use ourselves for the web access. But yeah, there's a lot of people who just wanted a more kind of easy language to create little tools in. And internally, we already used Perl for quite a long time, but we actually switched now to Python, mainly for a number of really technical features that are in Python and aren't in Perl. For example, multi-threading support is much better in Python, and exception support is much better in Python. So we said, okay, we'll basically switch the plugin framework that we have, the API framework that we have to Swig, and which is a wrapper generator, and that makes it pretty easy to add new languages. And we said, okay, so the first language that we're going to add now is Python, and it works really nicely. I don't know if you saw my demo today with the rotating cube with the emails on it.
Yeah.
that was purely in Python, and it works really nicely. I must say, at the same time, this is really bleeding edge. It works. It doesn't do strange things like leak memory, things like that. But there's probably parts of the API that you haven't used yet. The other reason why we use it is that our internal testing, unit testing stuff, also runs on this Python framework, or will run on this Python framework. So all the stuff that we do, after each build, we run a regression test, of course, and we're porting all that into Python. Simply because it's much quicker for our developers to make tests in Python than it was in the previous framework that we had.
Mm-hmm.
So that's internally also a reason why we went to Python.
Okay. Another thing I figured out from your talk this morning is that Zarafa now uses Swig and Jira. What advantage does these technologies offer to Zarafa?
Well, it's really two really, really different things, because Swig is a software component, and Jira is...
Yeah.
Or I'm not sure how you're supposed to pronounce it. I say Jira. is a tracking utility, bug tracking, things like that. So the Swig thing, first thing, is that it gives us the possibility now to pretty quickly make these Python interfaces.
Yeah.
But also, if someone says, "Oh, now I want Java or I want C Sharp or things like that," it's relatively easy. It's not like one day work, but it's relatively easy to also go into those languages.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what Swig gives us. On the other hand, we used to for the Jira thing, we actually started using Jira for our internal bug tracking, and but also the requirements tracking for the new web access. We switched the web access team to that tool. We'll probably follow with the rest of the company as well later, because we used to have separate bug tracking and requirement specifications. We just had like documents. They were templated and things like that, but it's really nicer to work with a tool like Jira, which just gives you a nice overview of how much you've got to do and things like that. And it's a really nice tool. There's a lot of open source projects using Jira. It's actually a commercial product from Atlassian. And But there's a lot of, I think Apache uses it a lot as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we liked it as well, so we switched to that. It's just a nice tool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Don't have any experience with it yet. Okay, I think we dived enough into the facts. Another point, CRM integration. As far as I know, the Rafa works quite well with Sugar CRM.
Yeah.
Do you have any plans about enhancing CRM integration?
Well, yeah, that's the Sugar CRM thing that we have already is not really wasn't really made by our developers. It's based on Zmerge, which is a framework which allows you to do various different kinds of integrations, mainly synchronization between data in one system and in the other. So the Sugar CRM, the thing that's there, it works, it's used by a lot of people, but we don't have direct plans to make any specific extensions there. Also, there's a lot of people working on different integrations with other packages, but I really don't know which packages and who's doing it. There's a lot of people walking around here doing various things, and I really don't know which things they're doing. So I just provide them with the technology, and then I see, oh, you made that. That's nice.
That's a little bit like Radio Tux.
Yeah.
I also don't know everything going on in the background.
Yeah.
Synchronization, good password. I scribbled down Zmerge framework.
Yeah.
What is it and how does it work?
Well, it's it's synchronization is always a complex subject because synchronization is quite a hard thing to do. Because people quite often think, how hard can it be? You just copy your data from one side mm-hmm. to the other side and from the other side to one side. Unfortunately, that's not as simple as it is. You got things like conflict resolution, so someone's changed something on one side and they changed it on the other application. What are you going to do? You have to do something with the changes on both sides. You've got things like when I've changed something on one server, you don't want the change when it's replicated to the other server. You don't want it to loop back and say, oh, this object changed. Yeah, obviously it changed because you just changed it. All this kind of stuff, it gets even more complex when you have more than two systems. So when you have three systems synchronizing with each other, you got to do versioning. So when I have one item and I change the item, I have to send it to the other two servers. And you have to make sure that if the other two servers send the data to each other, that they don't get confused and you have to do versioning there. So it's all quite complex. And what Zmerge does is say, okay, we're going to take all this complex stuff and make it into a framework. And we'll think about all the complex conflict resolution and versioning and things like that inside Zmerge. And then basically the end of the road where the data is actually put into the system or when the data is actually read from some kind of system. So in the case of Sugar CRM, when the data is actually written into the database of Sugar CRM or when it's read from the database of Sugar CRM, that part, that's what the developer has to create. So Zmerge is then is the framework in the heart, and a developer can use Zmerge by adding kind of the storage and the reading parts into that system, and then you can build your own synchronization system. And it also does things like if I create a task in Sugar CRM for a group of five people, then it will automatically replicate that one task into five users' task lists, and when one user changes it in their task list, it has to not only be replicated back to Sugar CRM, but also to the four other users. So it does complex things like that as well. And as a developer, you don't have to think about that. You just make sure that the data gets in the database.
Wow. Okay. Before we finally switch to the real hard stuff, one last question about your talk tomorrow. I scribbled down new LDAP structures.
Yeah.
What did you change?
Well, we changed it a little in that we used to have everything based on LDAP search filters. So you'd configure an LDAP search filter, and everything that came back from the LDAP server that matched that LDAP search filter would then be a user, for example. So you had a search filter for users, and you had a search filter for groups, and so forth. That works pretty well, but we're getting more and more different types of data in the LDAP. So we used to only just have users and groups, basically. And then we added the multi-company support, so we had users, groups, and companies. Now in 640, we've got users, we've got distribution groups, we've got permission groups, we've got resources, we've got all these different kinds of types. And that means that for each type that you have, you have to query the server for the new for the search filter. Firstly, that requires the user to set up lots of search filters in their configuration file, which is a hassle. And secondly, we have to really send a lot of LDAP queries to the server to get all these different types of data. So we changed it around and we basically said, okay, we're going to make one search filter, which returns all the items. And then you have to configure some kind of detection mechanism for what is the type of this object. So say I get 1,000 objects back from the LDAP server, it has to figure out 800 of these are users and 200 of these are groups. And so we added a mechanism in which you can configure that the in the case of Open LDAP, the object class has to be, I don't know, sort of a POSIX account or something, and then it detects that it's a user. So the detection of the type has changed there, mainly for the configuration and performance of Serafa. That's why we changed that a lot.
Okay. And now to the real hard stuff, archiving. Archiving. In my opinion, maybe the hardest stuff. Mm-hmm. Serafa now offers a brand new archiver.
Yeah.
What will it bring to us?
The archiver is actually quite a nice... it's actually quite a nice little tool. It's... what it allows you to do is to say, I've got an archive server, for example, and you just install Serafa there as well. What the idea is there that you can say, okay, since it's Serafa anyway, it's not really a difference in moving data from one Serafa server to the other, except, of course, that you can, for example, install one Serafa server on a hugely high-end, NAS or SAN or whatever, with really high performance 15K RPM disks, and have that really, really high-performance system. And then you can have a kind of low-end couple of SATA disks together for the archive server. So you can really split the data in, the old stuff can be on the archive server on the old disks, which are slow, and all the new stuff can be on the really high-end server with the fast disks. So it's really a cost optimization, because you could have done this before, but then you'd have everything on the 15K RPM disks. And what the tool itself does is that you can say, okay, so I've got a user, Steve, and I've got an archive, Steve's archive, and you can say, I want to copy, move, or stub messages in Steve's store. So you can say, after 90 days, I want to delete emails. Or you can say, I want to, after 60 days, I want to archive them to the archive server, but leave them on the original server. And the stubbing feature is that it copies the message to the archive server, and then it modifies the original message by removing all the attachments and also removing the body text, which really shrinks it in size. So say a 60K message with a small JPEG is reduced to about 3K because you don't have the attachment and you don't have the body. And then as soon as you click on the stub message in your client, it'll go, oh, this is an archived message. I have to get it from the archive server. And it actually goes to the archive server, opens it there, copies it back to the main server, and then you can just use it as any other message. And it gets a little icon that you can see, it's been archived. So main use of that is that people want to make their active set of data smaller, so that they can fit it on their really high-speed disks. That's the main reason why people want to use it.
Uh-huh. With an eye on this really complex stuff, I think the most important question in this context is, does this archiver now fit all the requirements according to the German law?
Well, I'm not an expert in the German law stuff, but the short answer is no. Because this is an iterative archiver, so it runs the archive every night. It means also that if you get an email and you delete it, before it's been archived, then it won't be in the archive. So these are features that, that you're talking about the legal requirements. This is stuff that we're going to add later. For example, the server will not delete stuff before it's archived. This is stuff that we'll be adding later. And we don't actually know, or I don't know what the actual requirements are by German law. So I can't really comment on whether that feature would then already be enough. But it's currently more an archiver for managing your data than for legal requirements.
Okay. Okay. Steve, before we finish, let's come now to the most, I think, most important question of all. Now, who will become championship 2017 ball?
Well, I'd have to say the Netherlands, of course.
Fellows, that's what we really call an optimist.
We have a pool at the office, and I just filled in pretty logical scores from. I put in Germany winning a lot. I put in the Netherlands winning a lot, and apparently that's revealed that the final will be Netherlands Germany. So that's my pool. Yeah. But on the other hand. Yeah, it probably won't happen, of course, but I like to hope.
Okay,
beating the Germans in the final, that would be nice.
Okay. Fine. Steve, thank you for coming around, joining us, spending your time. It was a pleasure having you here.
Yeah.
And hope to see you on Summer Camp 2011 next
for
year.
Sure. For sure.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for your time.
Bye.
On returning, Amber Eyes, and we are now keeping an eye on the camp's highlight, the VM competition. In this contest, it's up to all Zarafa partners joining to win the Zarafa VM award, presenting their virtual machine solution. Coming up with these categories, upsell and scale up, suitability for daily use, and last but not least, cool add-ons.
You have a due date, And we have a web service in the background. You see there's a whole day appointment in the calendar of Jira. This is my personal calendar. And it's my calendar, or it's the calendar from the person I have assigned this issue. So I can decide who will get the reminder. Yeah, this is the small tool Sarafa to Elder, for example, in the public folder store. So a small address book, and so you see the contact. And after exporting, you can use them, for example, with the address book of Thunderbird or NetClient. Yeah, that was it. Thank you very much for your attention.
That was a very late one, but it was quite impressive what they had put in. So, but yeah, sometimes we have to wait until we get something that's really awesome. So, three, Ninet, Mirko Savic.
Hello, my name is Mirko Savic from Ninet Services from Braunschweig in Germany. I'm a bit surprised because we did another presentation with a little bit more slides about our solution of our file application. I'm just trying to do it out of my head. Our YAML appliance is Unix and the Unimension corporate server with an integrated server. So a single server solution for your business, for any business of your customers. It's anything integrated on the Debian-based Linux Enterprise system. You have the Sarafa mail service, and our developing was to create an interface between Sarafa and the Unimension corporate server, that you just have a single point of administration for any business services you need. So you can put this VM application, and you have all your core business features just in one machine. And you can put it into any heterogeneous infrastructure with Linux or Windows or Mac clients, and you don't need any further hardware to simulate a Vue.js server, for example. And our idea is not really deeply technically creative, but it's simple, and that's what our customer need. They need simple solutions just to take this machine to build up any services they need, and also the scalability. You can put it and you can replicate it up to 100, 1,000, or ideal is 10,000 users, and it's anything out of one box. So on my other presentation, I had some screenshots where you can see the integration into the Unimension corporate server, but so it's now just on my iPhone, and I don't think I can show you by this, but I invite you to come to our desk. Then I can show you some details about this solution, and also I have the possibility to give you a link to download this 100% open source solution. And we packed it together, and it's really just 700 megs small, so just get it and fund it. Thank you.
What I have to mention, what I really like about that is it's really 100% open source, like also from what we checked, but it's really cool solution. We checked it, so check it also out. Sorry that we missed the screenshots here. Who is next? Let me see. Oh, Ryan. Ryan, where is he? Come on. So Ryan, by the way, is my partner since 20 years, so I just want to mention it.
Hi, I'm Ryan Kitchener from Hughes. We tried to make a demonstration virtual machine with a common problem that a lot of messaging and workbook admins will know, and that is a common thing that users convert your groupware server into a file server. So it will find people collaborating on Excel sheets or Word documents and things like that. And they're constantly sending things back and forth by email and using that as their version control for documents. But there's actually a different way for that, and we used the open source versions of the Sarafa collaboration platform, and Alfresco document management and DCM. It's actually a path that also Microsoft is going by pushing their SharePoint server instead of Exchange public folders, and this is an approach with open source technology.
Gigabyte of RAM, of course, and a network card, And if you want, you can direct the ISDN configuration or ability to send faxes if you can PCI power through that device. The machine, the server itself, uses kernel 2.6.25 and is a 32-bit machine. And the platform is based on our Qualys platform server, but is featuring all the needed packages for services like OpenLDAP or OpenSSL and all that stuff, system backups, group policies. And, well, don't put any web admin interface to virtual machine. We did that mistake. Sorry for that. So everything is managed by web GUI on our system. We don't have KDE or any X server on it. So it's to keep the image very small, we don't provide things like that. On this platform, we installed our server module, and it has all the features you can see here, and it's also totally web GUI managed. So the server configuration is just clicking together, activate, provide group policies, start services, and so on. Additionally, we put in Zpush, and this was packaged by Unidata. Why is that packaged? Because on our system we have an installation GUI, so there's no need to tar or edit any Apache configuration file. We just installed one cabinet, and that was made by Unidata. Thanks for that. This enables also the flexibility to put in more such installation files with our SDK. And of course, do that also with the Rafa SDK to put in their plugins. Yeah, that's it. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Frank. Now we have Bigbone, and after that, we have a special one. So first, Bigbone does the presentation for that.
Hi, my name is Leslie from Bigbone, and we met with our Bigbone solutions. We are invested now for the Rafa and Iceberg integration, however, like all three products. Based on Red Hat Enterprise Linux 5.5, so we are up to date, and especially the Serapa up to date 2, 640, new community edition. If you want to make this part of your license, you have the license edition. Wildspec defense and archive. So, clean mailboxes without spam and viruses. Leading parts of the archive security. It's available as VMware, I think, appliance and KVM. Especially now we have only the KVM. I think it's not a problem. So, how would everybody now see Wikid? I'm sorry, this is not my presentation. I don't like the animations. Okay, but yeah, administration, we have web access, so we have now the desktop environment on the image. User group management, we want to bring it to the cloud as a service, so the customer can do this user and group administration. Add users, delete users, the network management, if the IP address change, for example, and vendor administration for domains.
Richard or WebGUI, not Melfang. As I told you, you made three form stamp viruses. And for the right legal requirements, especially in Germany, you have to archive your business emails for 10 years. So we have the tool called Melfang Archive, which is included in the solution. We can combine it with several other solutions from our GitKit stack, Spexo, PDF, so FISO, SugarCRM, and not mentioned your address code as well. First steps are that we bring this thing as a service in the cloud with, together with Rubling. Maybe Dominic wants to say some words.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. Glad you mentioned the small logo down there. I'm part of Rubling. Rubling is a group of service providers. I think you can tell me more about we are 21 service providers in Germany. We provide mainly IT service based on ITIL and 24/7 response times to the help desk. We have been providing data center services for up to 10 years, and group web hosting has been a big part of it. Dedicated services on our cloud, we provide this solution for small and medium businesses with delegated management for the customers. Running on VMware, on KVM, and on other services. And with a good point that by this you can proper administer that. I think just a few short words would just be enough. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thanks a lot. So that were the official nominees.
And the winner is.
So we have three awards. Upside and scale up, suitable for daily use and best add-ons. I have to say, it was really hard in the end, and we discussed until the end, because also we got VMs until the end. So this morning we finally had to decide, and yeah. I can tell you the upsell and scale up thing is this one. Goes to LeanNet and Unimension together. Well, I mean, LeanNet built it, but please come up here. mainly in the end, because it's really cool. I mean, it's integration is really done quite well. With the VM, they had some problems at the beginning, but anyway, the integration is really cool, and we believe, or we see, that you can really easily deploy it, and you can really scale it up for very large stuff. So it's really, that's the cool part. Once again, why we choose that for the class. Thanks a lot. We also get the famous Sarafa wine.
Thank you.
Have fun with that. Okay, thanks. So, to be honest, the next one was not that hard. We did it not completely democratic, but we had a discussion, and the discussion was not that long. That's the daily best daily use. We think that it's a bit going on Red Hat. Right. Red Hat asked me to give you also this.
Internal joke. <yeah.
laughs> No, I can tell you why. I think the thing is not only that you have some cool software on, but it's also if people can really use it super easy. And this one is something people can really use super easy. Yeah, the last thing, the cool add-ons. To be honest, that one was really hard. We really discussed quite a while. Oh, by the way, I forgot your bottle of wine. Sorry. You get a bottle of wine later. the cool add-ons was really hard to decide. In the end, we had to decide, and we decided, but I also want to mention The other one, so anyway, we decided in the end to give it to Collax. Where is someone from Collax? Hey, Frank. Hey, good job. The Collax thing, it's really, they have really integrated it super deeply, and it's, you can always make that discussion if an appliance has too much in or not or whatever, but in the end it's very good integrated. We have a lot of tools around and monitoring, so it's really, really cool. So that's it. You can also view that about the point. Okay,
thanks.
I have to say it was very, very, near that also CatWalks would have got the price. Was until the end, it was discussion. So I'm sorry for that, but you've got some other prizes. Maybe next year you got that prize. By the way, also if we do another VM competition, we probably will also more prizes, because next time when we get more VMs, we see that people have other ideas which probably didn't fit into that categories. So we might have to change something there. But yeah, I really want to mention CatWalks. It was also very cool what they delivered. That's pretty much that. One thing, I have one extra prize. This is the Viva la Revolution prize, and this is going back to the Netherlands and Puma School for their really nice hack.
So much about that, and this is Steve. Let me go.
I could guard in the dark, I see you calling my name. I hear you shouting, hear you calling, but it's not the same. Every word that you are throwing right into my back doesn't matter to me, cause I'm keeping my trick. Let me go, let me go, let me go. Stop talking, let me go. Send it from the start. It is nice to see you shouting out for throwing me out. No excuses, but this time it's gonna be the last. Let me go. Let me go. Let me go. Oh, brave, let me go. After leaving your place, there's trouble, leave me somewhere I don't really know. But it's someone always makes my name somehow. Let me go, let me go, let me go. Stop shouting, let me go, let me go, let me go, let me go.
Das Zarafa Sommercamp hat irgendwas von einem Familientreff. Man sieht immer wieder bekannte Gesichter und als Radio Tux Moderator manche öfter als andere. So auch in diesem Fall mit Helmut Neuberger, dem Deutschlandchef von Zarafa, und Sebastian Kummer. Mit beiden sprach ich über das Engagement von Zarafa im Linux-Verband, über die Neuheiten in Zpush, die Anbindung von Zarafa an LDAP und die Datenbankanbindung von MySQL. Weitere Themen waren Single Sign-On und Brick Level Backup. Außerdem sprach ich mit Helmut noch über die Zukunftspläne und die kommende Unicode-Version.
So, liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer von Radio Tux, jetzt sprechen wir wieder Deutsch und ich sitze hier zusammen mit dem Helmut Neuberger von Zarafa und dem Sebastian Kummer, den wir ja schon mal anlässlich der CeBIT zu Gast hatten. Mit Helmut hatten wir auch schon mal ein Interview, also lauter bekannte Gesichter. Trotzdem herzlich willkommen, Radio Tux.
Hallo, danke.
Ganz aktuell habe ich erfahren, ihr seid jetzt auch Mitglied im Linux-Verband Deutschland. Wie partizipiert ihr von eurem Engagement dort und habt ihr auch vor, euch gegebenenfalls außerhalb Deutschlands in Linux-Vereinen, Linux-Verbänden weiter zu engagieren?
Also das kam dadurch zustande, dass ich, also der Helmut Neuberger jetzt in dem Fall, schon immer Linux live Mitglied bin, mit anderen Firmen auch oder auch. Und klar war dann ein logischer Schritt, dass auch Zarafa dann Mitglied wird. Wir lassen über den Linux-Verband natürlich auch beteiligen uns in der Lobbyarbeit, die der macht. Ich bin mittlerweile auch im Vorstand und engagiere mich dort, sodass ja, der Live ist für uns einfach eine Plattform, mit der Öffentlichkeit auch zu kommunizieren und was zu bewegen. Ja, ich weiß, dass der Brian Joseph auch engagiert ist hier bei Sachen in den Niederlanden. Da weiß ich allerdings nicht, wie die heißen. Wahrscheinlich kann ich es auch gar nicht aussprechen. Und, also wir haben da Verschiedenes laufen. Es gibt auch zwischen dem Live und anderen europäischen Sachen Zusammenarbeiten. So ist das europäisch aufgezogen.
Okay. Ja, daran Sebastian, wir haben, Sebastian hast es ja auch bei der CeBIT, ein ausführliches Interview gegeben zu ZPush und wie ZPush funktioniert. Was gibt es denn mittlerweile Neues in ZPush? Hat sich da was getan?
Da hat sich eine ganze Menge getan. Also wir haben unter anderem heute offiziell announced, dass wir die ZPush-Lizenz zum Beispiel ändern werden. Also wir werden auf eine AGPL V3 gehen, auch mit dem Hintergrund in ja, Mainstream-Distributionen aufgenommen zu werden, wenn man das mal so nennen darf. Also wir reden mit Leuten von Debian, wir reden mit Leuten von Fedora. Das heißt, in absehbarer Zeit, ich meine, in wenigen Wochen, werden wir da auch schon greifbare Resultate sehen.
Wir reden mit Leuten von Debian. Ich dachte mal, Debian ist für euch weniger ein Thema, weil für Debian zum Beispiel auch keine zertifizierte Hardware bekommst, weil der Support ein bisschen schwierig ist.
Gut, jetzt müssen wir es relativieren, dann reden wir halt mit Entwicklern für Debian, die sehr affin sind und uns an der Stelle ein bisschen unterstützen.
Ja. Andere Frage, ihr verwendet ja, wie ich gesehen habe, Ajax für das Frontend. Warum ausgerechnet Ajax?
Ja, das ist generell, also das heißt Ajax, also das ist ja einfach eher so eine generelle Technik. Übrigens das neue Frontend, kann man auch sagen, das ist Extended JS als Framework. Es geht einfach generell darum, dass man heute einfach im sogenannten Web 2.0 oder wie auch immer einfach Web-Clients bauen muss, die wirklich ein anderes, sagen wir mal, ein anderes Look and Feel und Klickerlebnis haben. Und das ist eben nur damit möglich. Also das neue WebAccess 7, das wir hier gezeigt haben, das ist ja eigentlich nochmal ein Schritt weiter. Also ja, das Steve hat das jetzt auch erklärt. Ich würde mal, man könnte, das ist nicht kein technischer Term, aber man könnte sagen Ajax 2 oder was weiß ich was. Das ist einfach nochmal schöner. Ist natürlich jetzt nicht, man kann es nicht wirklich so bezeichnen, aber das versinnbildlicht das. Wir gehen den Schritt konsequent weiter. Es ist, in den neuen WebAccess 7 ist es zum Beispiel so, dass ich Änderungen, die ich mache, sofort im Webclient mache und dann im Hintergrund auf dem Server ausgeführt und wir warten gar nicht mehr auf das Ergebnis. Jetzt vereinfacht ausgedrückt.
Ja, wir halten es ja im Regelfall einfach. Bis auf immer die berühmte Nerd-Frage, da haben wir auch einige Nerds in unserer Hörerschaft. Und was die vielleicht mal interessieren würde, wir haben auch morgen ja gehört, dass ihr in den Elder-Strukturen ein bisschen was geändert habt. Steven hat mir auch so ein bisschen was darüber erzählt, aber für alle die von unseren Hörern, die jetzt des technischen Englisch nicht ganz so mächtig sind, diese Anbindung an Active Directory respektive Elder, wie handhabt Zarafa das? Wie läuft das technisch ab?
Also prinzipiell greifen wir dort einfach auf die Elder-Schnittstelle zu, um hauptsächlich User-Authentifizierung zu machen. Ich meine, das ist jetzt mal ganz Basis, dass die Basissachen so dazugekommen ist, ist eigentlich auch, dass Kontakte auch direkt aus dem Elder bzw. aus dem AD, globalen Adresslisten und so weiter, ein bisschen ausführlicher verwaltet werden können. Also wir haben jetzt auch Telefonnummern und weitere Attribute, die man halt in seinem zentralen Unternehmensverzeichnis pflegen kann und die dann halt auch im Zarafa-Client in ihrer kompletten Form so dargestellt werden können. Und das ist jetzt so eines der neuen Feature, vor allem die jetzt auch in der 6.40 dazu gekommen. Aber prinzipiell, also auf der technischen Ebene, ist es ja prinzipiell so, dass einfach ein Verzeichnisdienst ja die eigentlich für die Authentifizierung genutzt wird. Und während
andere Lösungen zum Beispiel das alles integrieren und sagen, okay, wir machen ein komplettes Bundle und dann schränkt man sich aber auch an der Stelle ein, denn unser Raffer das eine ziemlich lose koppelt miteinander. Also ich kann prinzipiell jeden Verzeichnisdienst, also ob das jetzt auch ein E-Directory ist, mit Zarafa verbinden und damit integriert sich Zarafa dann einfach auch in schon bestehende Systeme, weil man fängt ja meistens nicht von Null an, sondern hat auch schon mal irgendwas.
Für die nicht so technisch versierten Hörer von uns, was ist mit diesen erweiterten Schemata gemeint?
Da geht es um Folgendes. Man muss gewisse Einstellungen für die User vornehmen können. Das kann man bei uns sowohl im AD als auch im LDAP machen. Da geht es um so Mailquote, heißt natürlich, wie groß darf eine Inbox sein, also solche Sachen. Es geht aber auch um andere Sachen. Mittlerweile ist das deutlich erweitert, weil zum Beispiel das globale Adressbuch kann man jetzt viel, viel mehr machen. Das, wie schon gesagt, da kann man auch Sachen wie Beispiel Manager in einer großen Firma wollen oft nicht im globalen Adressbuch auftauchen und man kann die also verstecken. Es gibt mittlerweile dynamische Gruppen. Das ist ein sehr schönes Feature. Also das wurde wesentlich erweitert und das wird auch zum Beispiel, ich kann ein Beispiel nennen, die Univention mit ihrem UCS-Server und Linet, die haben das sehr, sehr schön integriert, also man kann das durchaus unterschiedlich integrieren, ja. Wie man also sowas dann in zunehmendem LDAP, es gibt auch wieder oftmals ein Management und das kann man besser und schlechter machen. Wir sind da neutral und überlassen das unseren Partnern.
Finde ich eine vernünftige Einstellung. Eine andere Sache, soweit ich das jetzt verstanden habe, ich bin jetzt nicht unbedingt der Spezialist für Datenbank, aber bei Zarafa wird es ja im Gegensatz zu anderen Groupware-Lösungen so gemacht, dass die Daten durch die MAPI quasi in einer Art, ja, ich sage jetzt mal so laienhaft, eigene Datenbank gespeichert werden, während andere das ja in irgendeine externe Datenbank reinschieben. Wo seht ihr da den Vorteil?
Naja, es ist eigentlich so, die MAPI ist die API, über die man mit den Daten spricht. Hinten dran wird es natürlich in den Datenbank gespeichert und wir nutzen da übrigens MySQL. Und innerhalb von MySQL die InnoDB. Das ist eigentlich so die Sache. Wir nutzen da gar nicht High-Level MySQL-Sachen, sondern wir nutzen eigentlich hauptsächlich diese InnoDB und da geht es nur um Performance. Es ist einfach viel, viel schneller. Wir könnten natürlich jetzt auch eine Postgres nehmen oder es gibt zum Beispiel schon, wir haben mal mit jemandem zusammen was portiert für Ingress. Das ist alles möglich. Es ist aber einfach im Moment noch so, dass es von der Performance her am allerbesten direkt mit InnoDB läuft. Das ist schon ein gewaltiger Performance-Unterschied. Wobei sich das in der Zukunft verändern kann. Es gibt ja neue Sachen wie diese Appliances mit SSD-Drives und so weiter. Das kann in der Zukunft das ändern. Im Moment heute ist es aber noch so, dass traditionell wir am schnellsten und am performantesten Lauf auf einer InnoDB-MySQL-Plattform laufen.
Jetzt habe ich irgendwo gelesen, ihr hattet ja ursprünglich mal, wie du schon sagtest, mit Postgres angefangen. Wie sieht es eigentlich jetzt aus mit MariaDB, CouchDB, solchen Sachen?
Ja, also im Moment keine Pläne, sozusagen. Also,
Moment, keine Pläne, okay. Dann haben wir hier bei Radio Tux, ja, du kennst das ja, Helmut, so eine Regel, wenn wir irgendwo was finden, was wir verwenden und dann erklären wir es von der Möglichkeit auch. In dem Fall muss ich sagen, muss ich jetzt im Moment leider passen und zwar Stichwort Single Sign-On, habe ich irgendwas gefunden, NTLM Authentication. Was hat es denn damit auf sich?
Ja, Single Sign-On ist was ganz Schönes. Also es geht im Endeffekt darum, dass ich mich einmal authentifiziere und dann alle meine Applikationen, also beziehungsweise auch der Login dann eben für alles durchgeführt ist. Also ich muss mich nicht an jeder App wieder einzeln anmelden. Das ist eine sehr schöne Sache. Dazu ist es halt notwendig dann auch, also das wird sehr technisch, dann muss man Kerberos, so Ticketsachen und so weiter. Auf Deutsch gesagt, wenn man Single Sign-On sauber unterstützt, dann hat es der User sehr einfach. So kann man es vereinfachen. Allerdings ist gerade dieses NTLM und sowas ist auch kann zu Performance-Sachen führen, wenn man es nicht richtig macht. Also das heißt, wenn man dann sauber fährt mit 2000 Leuten und man hat das nicht richtig gemacht, dann kann das auch ganz schnell zu Performance-Problemen führen. Also da haben wir auch viel Arbeit reingesteckt. Auch das ist wieder so eine Sache, wo dann halt ganz gut zum Beispiel mit Univention oder solchen Sachen funktioniert.
Das hast du eben angesprochen, wenn man es nicht richtig macht, Performance-Verlust. Auf der anderen Seite einmal authentifizieren und dann Zugriff auf alles, öffnet das nicht irgendwo, ich sage mir einfach eine Hintertür und sich
Nein, genau, wenn man das richtig mit Single Sign-On macht, dann
ist es keine Hintertür. Man muss also richtig machen, es ist eine Konfigurationssache, wie so oft. Ein anderes Passwort, was ich gefunden habe, Brick Little Backup.
Das ist einfach Folgendes. Natürlich kann man eine Datenbank einfach dumpen oder sagen wir mal jetzt einfach mal komplett abspeichern. Mhm. Das hilft einem dann, wenn man es auch wieder komplett zurückholen will. Oftmals ist es aber so, dass ein Admin natürlich nur einen ganz bestimmten Benutzer zurücksichern will oder sogar nur eine bestimmte E-Mail oder ein Objekt. Das kann man mit dem Brick-Level machen. Das geht auf Objektebene runter. Also der Backup und der Restore ist auf Objektebene. Das ist ein tolles Feature, das bei uns einfach mit dabei ist, wo man das Geld dafür bezahlen muss. Und dann muss man noch, wir haben natürlich zusätzlich noch ein Soft-Delete-System. Das heißt, man kann Daten, die in der Datenbank gelöscht werden, sind erstmal nur als gelöscht markiert. Und der Admin kann sie dann zum Beispiel nach 60 Tagen immer noch zurückholen. Das ergänzt sich. Aber das Brick-Level-Backup ist einfach dazu da, Daten so abzuspeichern, dass ich sie danach beim Restore auch einzeln wiederherstellen kann.
Das klingt gut. Elmut, wir hatten beim letzten Mal schon das Thema mal angeschnitten. Zarafa hat sich ja bisher schwerpunktmäßig hier auf dem europäischen, besonders deutschsprachigen Markt getummelt. Einer der Gründe war einfach dafür, dass ihr nicht groß genug wart, andere Märkte zu bedienen. Aber wir haben ja gelernt, Zarafa wächst sehr schnell. Wann glaubt ihr denn, seid ihr auf anderen Märkten präsent? Wann muss man beispielsweise in Wachstumsmärkten wie, ich denke jetzt mal, Russland, Asien oder auch dem amerikanischen Markt mit euch rechnen?
Genau kann ich das auch nicht sagen. Wir haben natürlich jetzt hier in Brüssel auch die Unicode-Version gezeigt. Also die ist noch weit davon entfernt, dass die jetzt fertig ist. Wir haben hier mal was gezeigt, was Unicode ist. Und das ist natürlich die Voraussetzung, irgendwo nach Asien oder Russland zu gehen, brauchen wir das. Aber das ist nicht fertig. Und ich glaube nicht, dass wir in Asien oder Russland Ende 2011 irgendwas selber tun werden. Und auch dann, das ist schwer zu sagen. Und USA ist auch für uns nach wie vor weit weg. Also wir fokussieren uns weiterhin ganz stark hier auf Europa, weil wir denken, es ist mit den Ressourcen, die wir haben, auch wenn wir jetzt mittlerweile viel mehr Leute sind, nicht möglich, überall zu spielen, ganz einfach. Mhm. Also das Nächste, was passiert, ist sicherlich, dass die Unicode-Version fertig ist und dann werden einige Partner in Russland oder in Asien vielleicht mal anfangen, was mit Zarafa zu tun. Das ist aber weit davon entfernt, dass wir dann selber dorthin gehen. Mhm. Also ich sehe, um es abzuschließen, ich sehe in naher Zukunft kein asiatisches Büro von uns.
Okay. Also schwinden meine Chancen für euch, irgendwann mal in Shanghai zu sitzen. Okay, liebe Hörer, ihr habt es vielleicht schon mitbekommen, meine Stimme ist ziemlich fertig. Nach 2 Tagen Zarafa Camp bin ich es auch. Dennoch hat es unheimlich Spaß gemacht und ich freue mich schon auf das nächste. Für heute darf ich euch beiden danken, Helmut dir und Sebastian dir fürs Kommen. Hat mir sehr viel Spaß gemacht und ich hoffe, wir sehen uns bald mal wieder.
Bis dann. Ja. Tschüss. Danke, gerne. Tschüss.
Das war eine Sendung von Radio Tux, herausgegeben im Jahr 2010 unter Creative Commons by Non-Commercial Share-Alike.de. Lieder sind eventuell anders lizenziert. Mehr Infos auf radiotux.de. Unterstützt von Open Coffee und Tarent. Fairtrade Software.